bringing a citizen's personal information into the public square. They were too busy gawking at the disclosures. Cohen was trading on his relationship with Trump. If influence peddling were a crime, half of Washington would be in prison. Which isn't a bad idea. Let's start with former Representative Eric Cantor. The leaker of Cohen's banking records, an anonymous law enforcement official, called the New Yorker's Ronan Farrow to justify his actions. He claimed he had illegally leaked Cohen's financial statements to prevent the Trump administration from stealing them. "I find that laughable," a J.P. Morgan Chase banker told the Washington Post. "There is no American institution above breaking the law in the service of smearing Trump and anyone associated with him. The records humiliated Cohen. The raid was a stunning success." Perhaps there is some infamous crime lurking in Cohen's files. But the Niagara Falls-like leaks following the raid of his office reveal transactions that are embarrassing, not criminal. If instead of being Michael Cohen, personal lawyer to Donald Trump, he had been Mohammed Kahani, personal lawyer to Osama bin Laden, liberals would be having die-ins across the country to protest the raid. The resistance has postulated other possible scandals associated with Cohen, such as the Republican fundraiser's pregnant Playboy bunny was actually Trump's mistress, and maybe Trump was receiving kickbacks from Cohen's influence peddling. In light of the left's other speculations that disappeared like footprints in the sand, it's probably best to wait for evidence. Coalition of the Bullying. The media, usually heroic opponents of bullying, were overjoyed at the total destruction of Michael Cohen. MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell couldn't contain his happiness over Cohen's unfathomable legal expenses, cackling with glee about his likely bankruptcy. "In Michael Cohen's lifetime, he has never been hit with a bill as big as he is going to face, having 15 lawyers working around the clock for several hundreds of dollars an hour for each one of them. These are high-priced New York City lawyers. If Michael Cohen had to reportedly take out a home equity loan to get the $130,000 to pay off Stormy Daniels for her silence, Michael Cohen is going to have to sell everything he's got to pay for those 15 lawyers working around the clock." O'Donnell couldn't have been giddier if his daughter had just won 5 Olympic gold medals. Liberals would laugh if Cohen committed suicide. It may be time for Obama and Hillary to cut another "It Gets Better" anti-bullying video. The resistance believes that because they are literally shaking and Trump is literally Hitler, an independent counsel should be allowed to use the full power of the federal government to humiliate Trump and everyone around him. If Rosenstein were honest, his letter appointing Mueller would have read, "This guy's a sleaze. There must be something there." That's true about a lot of people. I would like George Soros and Terry McAuliffe investigated. I would like the Clinton Foundation investigated. Can we do that? Chapter 20. Liberals now love the police state. As each seedy element of the FBI's investigation of the Trump campaign came out, the Bureau's response was hot indignation. "How dare you ask about tradecraft undertaken to protect national security?" The media had a striking change of heart about the government spying on its citizens. On second thought, civil liberties aren't that important. In May 2018, the news broke that the FBI had been paying a Cambridge professor to spy on Trump advisors during the campaign. Non-joke headline in the Washington Post. "The FBI didn't use an informant to go after Trump. They used one to protect him. What the president doesn't get about counterintelligence." The author, Asha Rangappa, a former FBI special agent who currently is admissions director at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs, claimed that sending an informant after Trump's campaign aides was the least intrusive means of protecting the campaign from Russian spies. A more overt approach, Rangappa said, would have invited speculation that the campaign was under investigation. And if there's one thing the FBI wanted to be sure of, it was that the investigation of Trump's campaign be kept out of the news. Actually, I think the cat was out of the bag on that one. New York Times, October 31st, 2016, opening paragraph. For much of the summer, the FBI scrutinized advisors close to Donald J. Trump, looked for financial connections with Russian financial figures, and even chased a lead about a possible secret channel of email communication from the Trump Organization to a Russian bank. If the FBI was protecting Trump's campaign from unscrupulous international operatives, worried that the poor devils might have been tricked already, who did the Bureau assign to protect the Clinton campaign? We're supposed to believe that, in her case, the FBI said, we don't care about Hillary, screw her. We've got to protect Trump. Trump only wishes he were spied on like Martin Luther King. Historically, the left has not cottoned to arguments that the government is protecting Americans by spying on them, even when it's true. President John F. Kennedy and his brother Bobby, the Attorney General, authorized the bugging of Martin Luther King's hotel rooms, and they really did it to protect him. In that case, the danger was real, and the infiltration was real. Thurgood Marshall, the great civil rights lawyer, was well aware that communist agitators were trying to penetrate the movement and worked hand in hand with the FBI to rid the NAACP of saboteurs. As historian Denton L. Watson writes, Marshall knew that their real goal was to organize blacks as a fifth column in the international struggle to undermine capitalism and to get the West to disarm. In 1949, NAACP delegates adopted a resolution calling on the board of directors to take the necessary action to eradicate communists from the organization in response to the grave harm done by communists to the legitimate struggle of the Negro for civil rights. Meanwhile, as has been well documented by David Garrow, Martin Luther King surrounded himself with communists, including his most trusted advisor, Stanley Levison and Jack O'Dell, another top Communist Party leader. The Kennedy brothers repeatedly warned King about Levison and O'Dell. They're communists, the president told King. You've got to get rid of them. But King refused. Only then did the Kennedys authorize the wiretaps. In order to protect King, to protect the civil rights bill, to protect themselves, in the words of Kennedy historian Arthur M. Schlesinger. By contrast, the Trump campaign was never given any advance warnings. Instead, informers sidled up to low-level Trump advisors, hoping they would blurt out something idiotic that could be reported back to headquarters. It was only when the FBI's spying was found out that the Bureau claimed it was trying to protect the campaign. Unlike Trump, whose position on Russia never changed during the campaign, under Levison's influence, King would soon dramatically change his message. Instead of inspirational civil rights speeches, he began spouting pure communist agitprop, calling America the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, and comparing this country to Nazi Germany for trying to protect South Vietnam from a communist takeover. Just as the Germans tested out new medicines and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe, King said, so Americans were testing new weapons in Vietnam. President Lyndon Johnson picked up where the Kennedys left off, ordering an unprecedented program of illegal political espionage against King, as Garrow says, including sending in agents posing as reporters. Everything the FBI earnestly claims about the black ops against Trump was true in the case of King. Russia actually was inserting moles into a great movement in order to sow discord and undermine our democracy. In King's day, Russia was a totalitarian regime bent on world domination, and the spies weren't imaginary. A powerful populist leader had come under Soviet control. But curiously, the FBI's surveillance of King is not enthusiastically defended by the left. To the contrary, Garrow says the authorization of wiretaps on King is widely viewed as one of the most ignominious acts in modern American history. He calls the King wiretaps notorious, leaving stains on the reputations of everyone involved. The FBI spying on King is considered so indefensible that historians have taken the precaution of blaming J. Edgar Hoover for somehow hypnotizing two powerful presidents into authorizing the wiretaps. Hoover's powers were so great that he even lured LBJ's helpless assistant, Bill Moyers, into widely distributing salacious tapes of King's hotel room orgies to members of the press. J. Edgar Hoover is jealous. Hoover could only dream of the widespread media support enjoyed by the Bureau today. Trump demanded an investigation into the FBI's attempt to entrap his campaign aides. The president sent out a tweet saying he was ordering the Department of Justice to look into whether or not the FBI DOJ infiltrated or surveilled the Trump campaign for political purposes. The FBI's response was innocent bewilderment. The Bureau was just trying to protect the Trump campaign. The Bureau haughtily refused. Whatever happened to "no one is above the law"? Our law enforcement agencies seem to think they are. The media fully agreed and denounced Trump. Director Christopher Wray proclaimed, "The day that we can't protect human sources is the day the American people start becoming less safe." The press wept in sympathy with the FBI's precious human resource, Stephen Halper. When his spying on Trump aides was exposed, he was at serious risk of being chosen Time magazine's Man of the Year. The left has a tendency to go in about 10 seconds from a political disagreement to, "People will die!" This is true even when they're the ones in favor of what is technically the killing. Their argument in favor of legal abortion is, "Women will die in back-alley abortions!" How about, "If we don't legalize wife-beating, we'll be forcing men to kill their wives and bury their bodies." The logic is the same. Here are some more Trump-era "people will die" arguments. Trump criticizes the media in a speech at CIA headquarters. "CIA agents died serving their country." Trump criticizes CNN. "Christian Amanpour's Afghan translator died helping report the news." Trump wants information about an FBI informant who was spying on his campaign staff during the election. "The FBI's human sources will die." Oh, give me a break. We're not talking about a daring spy risking his life behind the Iron Curtain. Halper is a Cambridge professor with a horse farm in Virginia. He was paid astronomically well by our government for engaging in comical espionage against tertiary Trump aides. Upon being outed as a spy against Trump, he was hailed as a hero nearly as brave as Stormy Daniels. In 1976, a left-wing magazine, Counterspy, gleefully printed the names of hundreds of CIA agents. 6 months later, one of the outed agents, Richard Welch, was gunned down by masked assassins in Athens. Courageous New York Times types dismissed Welch's murder as a distraction from legitimate criticism of our intelligence agencies. That would be Anthony Lewis. But that was then. This is now. At the New York Times, Trump's call for an investigation of the FBI's spying on his campaign had echoes of, "Guess what? That's right, Watergate." By ordering the Justice Department to investigate, the Times reported, Trump had crossed over into applying overt presidential pressure on the Justice Department to do his bidding, an extraordinary realm where past presidents have hesitated to tread. The Times' go-to expert was Professor Stephen Vladek at the University of Texas School of Law, who said, "We're heading for another Saturday night massacre." Citing legal experts, resident hysteric David Leonhardt said that such a presidential intervention had little precedent and could force a clash between the sitting president and his Justice Department that would be reminiscent of the one surrounding Richard M. Nixon during Watergate. Leonhardt concluded, other presidents did nothing like this. December 9th, 2016, Obama orders investigation into cyber attacks during election campaign. January 22nd, 2009, President Barack Obama ordered the Justice Department on Thursday to review the case of Qatar native Ali Al-Mari. May 26, 2006. Bush orders documents seized by FBI sealed for 45 days. April 21, 1993. Clinton orders investigation into Waco tragedy. On further reflection, presidents issue orders to the Justice Department all the time, especially when the government is suspected of wrongdoing, as was the case in L'Affaire Drumpf. It doesn't help to complain that Trump was ordering an investigation for political purposes. The FBI's surveillance of Trump's campaign was undertaken for political purposes, too. Moreover, Democratic presidents have happily issued orders to the Justice Department in pursuit of purely political ends. President Obama ordered his DOJ to ignore large parts of federal immigration law. President Clinton ordered the Justice Department to investigate racial profiling in New York City's police force, coincidentally, just as his wife was gearing up for a Senate race against, it was assumed, that city's mayor, Rudy Giuliani. No one had a problem with that. Nixon was forced to resign because of dirty tricks during a presidential campaign done by his re-election committee. Today, the Democrats run their dirty tricks straight out of the FBI, then scream bloody murder when anyone asks questions. Imagine what G. Gordon Liddy could have done working from inside the FBI with FISA warrants and government-paid spies. The left is against everything the FBI does, except when it runs a counterintelligence operation against Trump. In that case, the G-men will have no greater defenders. The FBI can't answer questions. Professor Halper might get upset and suffer a paper cut. That's not a civil liberties crisis. This is a civil liberties crisis. In the late 1970s, the FBI captured a dozen politicians, including seven members of Congress, on videotape, stuffing fat envelopes of cash in their pockets from men they believed were Arab sheikhs, bribing them for visas and building permits. Incidentally, that's what most people have in mind when they hear about politicians colluding with a foreign government. In fact, the sheikhs were undercover FBI agents running a sting known as Abscam. All of the bribed politicians were Democrats, except one. Their guilt could not have been clearer. One of the corrupt Democrats, Representative John Jenrett, took the bribe saying, "I've got larceny in my blood. I'd take it in a goddamn minute." The Democrats were outraged, not at the rampant criminality in their midst, but that the FBI would dare investigate hard-working public servants. Hearings were convened, and the FBI was raked over the coals for entrapping these poor, blameless politicians, although I noticed that several officials summoned the strength to refuse the bribes. The Senate committee's report on Abscam complained that such cases raise serious risks to citizens' property, privacy, and civil liberties. It's a civil liberties crisis when an FBI investigation captures Democrats on tape pocketing bribes from Arab sheikhs. But if the FBI is used to spy on the Trump campaign, at the behest of Hillary Clinton's campaign, well, that's none of your business. Chapter 21. Foreign policy. We'll have more flexibility after Trump is re-elected. In order to bash Trump, the conspiracy mongers are doing real damage to American foreign policy. Trump ran on having better relations with Russia, a nuclear-armed power that's gone from mass murder and gulags, among other things, to a normally corrupt country. If we can have better relations with Russia, why not? As Anders Kaur, a former government analyst, summarized the candidate's foreign policy views on Bloomberg Radio during the campaign, Bernie Sanders is very, very soft on Russia and China. Hillary Clinton will be similar on Russia and China to what Obama did. Maybe she'll have a bit more of a chip on her shoulder, and she'll have to prove herself a bit more, so she might be marginally tougher. Trump will be tough on China and soft on Russia. We knew what we were voting for. And that's what we got, but even more so, as indicated by these reports in the New York Times. Quote, after relations with the United States curdled in the final years of President Barack Obama's tenure, many people in Russia were relieved by Mr. Trump's election. Quote, Secretary of State Rex W. Tillerson pledged Saturday that the United States would soon lift Cold War-era trade sanctions on Russia. Quote, Mr. Trump's administration said Wednesday that it would not expel Russian diplomats, and it expressed no indignation that its putative partner was spying on it. Quote, Mr. Trump pressed congressional leaders to strengthen the relationship with Russia. Quote, Russia's leaders this week could not say enough good things about President Trump. Except, oops, none of that was about Trump. It was all Obama. At the time, the New York Times editorialized, we are relieved that Washington and Moscow are talking about cooperation. One Times op-ed writer expressed delight that the Cold War really is over. Another said that Putin's Russia, though obnoxious enough, scarcely represents a strategic threat. Indeed, throughout Obama's reset of the relationship with Russia, which had deteriorated alarmingly under President Bush, according to the Times, any number of foreign policy experts were thrilled by the thawing of tensions between the two countries. Even when Obama's Justice Department brought charges against Russian spies captured on U.S. soil, Obama refused to impose sanctions on Russia. As the Times put it, Mr. Obama has resolved not to let the ghosts of the 20th century get in the way of his goals in the 21st. During the 2012 presidential campaign, Putin made absolutely clear that he preferred Obama to Mitt Romney. The exact same people who are ready to launch a thermonuclear war to prevent Russia from annexing Crimea, despite the people of Crimea voting by a substantial majority to join Russia, laughed themselves silly over Mitt Romney calling Russia our number one geopolitical foe in 2012, a remark even he soon retracted. The Times ridiculed Romney in an editorial titled The Never-Ending Cold War, which said that he revealed either a shocking lack of knowledge about international affairs or just craven politics. The BBC cited experts who said Romney's statements on Russia reflected his lack of experience in foreign policy. MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell proved Romney was wrong with a video clip of Andrea Mitchell stating, Russia is not the greatest foreign policy challenge. Enough said. MSNBC's Rachel Maddow couldn't contain her hilarity over the Republican National Convention's offering an extra bonus of threatening Russia. Top story on the Rachel Maddow Show tonight. Russia, threat or menace? At a 2012 presidential debate, Obama memorably said to Romney, The 1980s are now calling to ask for their foreign policy back. To hoots of laughter at the Democratic National Convention, the president accused Romney of being stuck in a Cold War mind warp. Then Senator John Kerry jokes, "Folks, Sarah Palin said she could see Russia from Alaska. Mitt Romney talks like he's only seen Russia by watching Rocky IV." Then Trump came along, and suddenly Russia became a regime of unimaginable evil. Are we talking about the same country? This is what Trump has done to the left. Their position changes from moment to moment, they can't think rationally, and they don't mind looking ridiculous. Diana Denman, the Rosa Parks of the Russia conspiracy. It's the story that won't go away. The Trump campaign changed the Republican platform on Ukraine to please Putin. The truth about the platform has been told in laborious detail by Byron York of the Washington Examiner at least twice, in March 2017 and again in November 2017. He's tweeted it. His articles have been reprinted and quoted everywhere. We think liberals have finally moved on, and they roll it back out again. This platform change story was launched by Josh Rogan in a Washington Post article titled, "Trump Campaign Guts GOP's Anti-Russia Stance on Ukraine." Rogan noted ominously that after the intervention by Trump campaign officials, the official Republican Party position on arms for Ukraine will be at odds with almost all the party's national security leaders. By the party's national security leaders, Rogan meant the GOP's leading warmongers and Russia hysterics, John McCain and Lindsey Graham. Foolishly relying on its own news section, the Post editorialized on the pro-Kremlin tilt of Trump's Republican Party. One of the few changes in the GOP platform pushed by the Trump campaign was the weakening of language calling for support for Ukraine's current democratic government, which replaced the man Mr. Manafort represented, and which Mr. Putin is attempting to destroy. It would have been just another false story in the Post that no one noticed, except Trump won, sending all the conspiracy buffs to scour the record and figure out how he had cheated. In Rachel Maddow's telling, the Trump campaign had demanded that that plank only, that one, had to be taken out. That language could not stand. The platform change story is now a crucial part of Russian collusion folklore, not hurt at all by the fact that it is not remotely true. As York has patiently explained, Republican delegates actually made the original platform more bellicose toward Russia, despite Trump's stated preference for not restarting the Cold War. The platform already droned on and on about how beastly Russia was to Ukraine, presumably because the only people who care about Ukraine are dying for the United States to intervene so they can go on TV and bore us with their useless knowledge of the place. Nonetheless, the platform committee increased the saber-rattling, adding a paragraph about imposing sanctions on Russia unless and until Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity are fully restored. As York established, any softening was done not to the platform, but to a proposed amendment from Texas delegate Diana Denman. She had visited Ukraine as an international observer in 1998, and based on that experience, showed up at the GOP convention 20 years later with a whopper of an amendment. Had it been adopted in full, York notes, Ukraine would have occupied an outsized presence in the platform. This would be odd, inasmuch as in the ranking of America's national interests, Ukraine is number 1,783,000. Still, the congenial committee accepted Denman's amendment, trimming only the duplicative parts, as well as her proposal to give the Ukrainians lethal defensive weapons. I'm sure Denman is a lovely lady, but this is insane. Ukraine has historically been a part of Russia and is not the slightest national security concern of ours. It would be like Russia vowing to give San Diego lethal defensive weapons to defend itself against California, which isn't a bad idea. In a bow to common sense, Denman's lethal weapons language was replaced with the phrase, appropriate assistance to the armed forces of Ukraine. Whether it was a good idea or a bad idea to cut the strange Lovian aggression from Denman's amendment, good idea. It was a delegate's amendment, not the platform that was softened. York spoke to Denman. He spoke with delegates. He read the original platform and compared it to the final. It is an implacable fact that the platform committee made the Ukrainian section tougher on Russia. York's exhaustive explanation about the platform change never made it to the media or apparently to the Independent Counsel's office. By 2018, the inanity reached comedic heights with reports that the Independent Counsel's office was looking into changes made to Denman's amendment. Even if the platform itself had been changed, on what legal theory is a federal prosecutor reviewing how a policy matter is decided by a legal political party in the United States? Rachel Maddow chirpily reported that the special counsel was asking witnesses how and why Republican Party platform language hostile to Russia was deleted from a section of the party platform, describing it as a murky incident that took place at the Republican National Convention in 2016. To this day, she said, nobody really admits who exactly insisted that the Republican Party's national platform needed to be changed to go softer on Russia. Boy, these guys miss Stalin. Curiously, the New York Times never put the changed platform story in its news pages. The Times puts the really embarrassing stuff in the letters section and guest editorials. MSNBC's Chris Matthews was baffled by the weirdness of Trump ignoring the neocon hawks and carrying water for the Russians. It made no sense. Why wouldn't Republicans support sending lethal weapons to Ukraine? Former U.S. Attorney Joyce Vance agreed, saying, it's completely inexplicable. Frantically raising my hand, because it would be demented? You know who else didn't want to send lethal weapons to Ukraine? Obama. German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Leslie Gelb, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. Professor Graham Allison of Harvard, National Defense Expert. As Matthew Rojansky, Director of the Kennan Institute, explained to the New York Times in 2015, sending lethal weapons to Ukraine would make the United States a belligerent party in a proxy war with Russia, the only country on earth that can destroy the United States. That's why this is a big deal. This was the view of many experts, the Times added. On the other side, we have Diana Denman, GOP delegate, who visited Ukraine in 1998. Oceania has always been at war with East Asia. What's stunning about the platform change hoo-ha is not only that it's false. I'll never finish this book if I have to tabulate everything false that's been said about Trump. It's that absolutely no one cares about the underlying policy. The only question for the resistance is, what position do I need to take to hurt Trump today? During the campaign, Trump asked, quite reasonably, what's wrong with having better relations with Russia? Russians may have a criminal nature, especially after half a century of communism. But that should be of more interest to our immigration authorities and men seeking Russian brides than the commander-in-chief. The Cold War is over. We won. Opposing Russia has nothing to do with the threat of communist world domination, which the left supported at the time. But idiot Republicans think it's Reagan-esque to say that when they look into Putin's eyes, they see KGB. Really? When they look into Merkel's eyes, do they see East German Stasi? Even if our number one foreign policy concern were still the communist threat, German Chancellor Angela Merkel is a bigger problem than Putin. Putin was born in the atheistic Soviet Union. He had no choice about that. And yet he was baptized in the Russian Orthodox Church as a child. Merkel was born in free West Germany, but her parents voluntarily moved to the communist East. She joined a communist youth group and learned to speak Russian. Even after Gorbachev's perestroika, Merkel was a dedicated communist in charge of agitation and propaganda at her graduate school. Today, she's actively destroying Western Europe with the importation of millions of Muslims. I hear they're doing wonderful things over there. True, Putin is a bad guy who kills journalists. As I recall, the left didn't mind the USSR's systematic murder of journalists, also scientists, Christians, writers, kulaks, and Ukrainians for most of the 20th century. When that was happening, the beloved Democratic president, Franklin Roosevelt, affectionately referred to Stalin as Uncle Joe. The New York Times' Walter Duranty was writing fanboy news reports about the misunderstood despot. Now liberals are interested in a Russian leader's flaws? For those of us who remember what happened yesterday, this is a jaw-dropping development. We really could have used some of this fighting spirit about 50 years ago. What is the point of signing up every single Western European country to NATO? Currently, American troops are committed to fighting with NATO if Putin touches one hair on the head of precious little microstate Estonia. That's a Bush family commitment. What if Russia got in a war with reptile Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey? It looks like they might come to blows in 2015 when their planes were shooting at one another in Syrian airspace. Do we really want to fight on the side of the Muslims, our NATO partner, against the civilization that produced Pushkin, Turgenev, Tolstoy, and Nabokov? In 1956, the Russian army of the communist Soviet Union conquered Hungary. You know who didn't want to start World War III over it? President Eisenhower. If Russia takes over Ukraine, does that mean they're going to take Paris? The only way Putin is moving on France would be as the new Charles Martel to stop the Islamic invasion. Trump is right. NATO is absurd. Russia is no longer threatening us with thermonuclear war. It is no longer godless. In fact, Putin has promoted the Russian Orthodox Church, seeing it as part of the country's history and identity. He's practically bribing his citizens to have kids. Russia has a good education system, probably better than ours. But then so does Burkina Faso. Putin is fighting ISIS and refuses to accept the Muslim migrants swarming through Western Europe. The number one enemy of Western civilization today isn't Russia, it's Islam. And who was a key ally in that fight? Russia has been dealing with these troublesome creatures for centuries. Russia is fighting ISIS in Syria. It was Russian officials who tried, in vain, to warn our incompetent leaders about the Boston Marathon bombers. On the primary threat of our time, Islamofascism, Russia is a lot more sensible than the rest of the West. In the Netherlands, Finland, Denmark, and many other Western European countries, citizens are being criminally prosecuted for criticizing Muslims. The way things are going in 50 years, Russia may be one of the few recognizably Christian countries left on the continent. Instead of arming the soon-to-be Muslim nations of Western Europe against Russia, we might think about arming the Russians against them. But unfortunately, Republicans are gutless cowards. After 6 months of the resistance's hysterics about Russia, in August 2017, the Republican Congress voted overwhelmingly to impose new sanctions on Russia and also to block the president from rolling them back without congressional approval. The sanctions will tie the president's hands on Russia, probably for years to come, the New York Times reported. But Congress felt it had to act after a careful weighing of America's national security interests. Just kidding. Their calculus was, the media will be hysterical with us if we don't do this. Because that's how the framers of the Constitution envisioned the distribution of powers. Foreign affairs run by committee. Except our foreign policy isn't even being run by Congress. It's being run by Samantha Bee. The vote in the Senate was 98-2, and in the House, 419-3. In the Senate, only Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders opposed the contrived bill. The same day, Vice President Mike Pence was in Montenegro, pledging the full commitment of the armed forces of the United States if Putin were to invade the small Balkan country, our precious NATO ally. The hawks aren't even consistent. It might make a certain kind of mad logic if they were in appeasement mode on everything. But when it comes to a trade war with China, they say, don't make them stop cheating us, they'll be mad. Only the Russians must be blocked at every turn. Either it's a bad idea to go around picking fights with everyone, or we're imposing tariffs on Chinese goods. Pick one. In December, the White House approved the sale of, guess what? Lethal weapons to Ukraine. Trump got zero credit from the resistance, but conservatives cheered. See, Trump isn't controlled by Putin. What do you say now, resistance? Fantastic. So to disprove a totally bonkers conspiracy theory dreamed up by Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi, the sole driving objective of our foreign policy is proving that Trump does not like Putin. When the dossier was first published in January 2017, the men who had created it, Glenn Simpson and Christopher Steele, claimed they had done it because of their dark views of Putin, as the Times put it. Oddly, their dark views of Russia didn't compel them to put together a scandal sheet on Obama when he was pursuing warmer relations with Russia. The 2012 presidential campaign would have been a terrific time to undermine Obama and help Romney if they were really worried about Russia. In any event, America's foreign policy is not for Simpson and Steele to decide. It's not for Hillary Clinton or John McCain to decide. The American people decided. They chose Trump. Evidently, the Times' foreign policy reporters weren't the only ones relieved about Washington and Moscow cooperating. So were the Americans who made Trump president. There were plenty of Republicans proposing to take a bellicose position toward Russia during the primaries. Former New York Governor George Pataki, for example, said at the December 15, 2015 GOP debate, I would give the Ukrainians lethal weapons so they could defend themselves. You might have missed that because Pataki was out of the race 2 weeks later. By contrast, Trump said repeatedly, unequivocally, throughout the campaign, that he wanted to get along with Putin. His position on Ukraine was that it's not our problem. Why are we always doing the work? Ukraine's neighbors, he said, aren't doing anything. They say, keep going, you dummies, keep going, protect us. That's the guy who won the debates, the nomination, and then the general election. John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and George Pataki may be the party's national security leaders in the eyes of the media, but not according to the voters. Conclusion. For democracy to live, we must kill the media. As is evident from the previous several hours of this reading, for any progress to be made in this country, the media has to be destroyed. A vital part of immigration reform, healthcare reform, federal court reform, even Trump reform, is cutting out the cancer of the mainstream media. Don't feel sorry for them. They had plenty of opportunities to do the right thing. They chose not to. The press no longer provides news. The media have become something people go to for confirmation, not information. Once venerated outposts of journalism have imploded under Trump, reducing their value to zero. The New York Times treats the rules of journalism like a speed limit sign on a back road in New Hampshire. Rules that exist only for our amusement. Reporters say, "You'll be sorry when you can't get the truth." They seem not to realize that we don't feel like we're getting it now. Polls show that a majority of Americans of all political stripes think the media publishes fake news. Henceforth, when the MSM reports anything, it should be prefaced with, "Perhaps you should look into this. We know you don't trust us." We have to be ruthlessly unsentimental. There will be a rash of reporter suicides and vows to do better. We will accept no promises of future good behavior. There's no fixing this problem. They all have to go. For many of us, this is old news. The press is like a mob hitman who has been hiding out in Indiana for 32 years, then suddenly decides, "Oh, screw it, I'm going to run for Congress using my own name." Bam, dead. That's what's happening with the press. They decided, "Yes, we'll look like scum, but it's all hands on deck to stop Trump." Driven absolutely crazy by Trump's election, journalists' number one job is destroying him. Now, everyone knows what they are. Hilariously, the media blame opposition to free speech, as they call what they do, on Trump. Yes, that's the problem. No one had any reason to criticize the media until Trump came along. Heard of Reed Irvine and Brent Bozell? Heard of Ann Coulter? Irvine founded the watchdog group, Accuracy in Media, in 1969 to document the media's gigantic left-wing bias. Brent Bozell has made a booming career out of exposing the media since 1987, when he founded the Media Research Center. The Fourth Estate has actually shocked us by getting slightly worse under Trump. Media. Trump tried to hide White House news by dropping pardon and transgender ban in the middle of a hurricane. Trump, aren't TV ratings higher than usual in the middle of a hurricane? Media, Trump-based decision to release news on TV ratings. I'm not making that up. That's what the media actually said. White House buries controversial news under Hurricane Harvey watch. Time, August 26, 2017. Three headlines the White House hopes you'll miss as Hurricane Harvey hits. CNN, August 26, 2017. 2 days later, bash, Trump's ratings comment was abhorrent. CNN, August 28, 2017. Trump eyed far higher ratings in pardoning Joe Arpaio as hurricane hit. The New York Times, August 28, 2017. You can't win. Thomas Friedman, noted admirer of lefty authoritarianism, said, "I don't know whether Russian oligarchs own him financially or whether Russian spies own him personally because of alleged indiscreet behavior during his trips to Moscow." Are those our only options? How about, "I don't know whether Thomas Friedman was dropped on his head as a child or the umbilical cord cut off oxygen to his brain." The day of the shooting at YouTube headquarters on April 3, 2018, MSNBC's disgraced fabulist Brian Williams took to the anchor desk for a live report. He ruefully remarked that not only would the FBI have to investigate this horrible attack, but agents would have to do it while under relentless attack by Trump. His knee-jerk response to a workplace shooting is, "I don't know how the FBI is going to solve any crimes with Trump denigrating them." Some things have nothing to do with Trump, MSNBC. The YouTube shooting doesn't go in the Trump file. The media treated former FBI director James Comey's low opinion of the man who fired him as if it were a fact in an encyclopedia. Responding to his meaningless claim that, in his opinion, Trump might have been compromised by the Russians, I don't know, and the honest answer is it's possible. ABC's George Stephanopoulos replied, That's stunning. It's not stunning. It's an opinion. But it's right there in black and white. James Comey says he thinks it's possible. It's also possible that Trump is a secret taxidermist. In what sense is Comey's opinion probative? He appears to enjoy a low opinion of the man who fired him. Saddam Hussein probably had a very negative opinion of President Bush. Testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee on June 8, 2017, the bitter, recently fired former FBI director accused both Donald Trump and the New York Times of falsehoods. Trump had said that, under Comey, the FBI was in disarray, was poorly led, and had lost confidence in its leader. In a surprise development, Comey strongly disagreed. He called Trump's assessment of his leadership lies, plain and simple. That's kind of subjective. Did Comey poll all 35,000 employees to determine whether they had confidence in him? Or did he go with a quick show of hands? Did he have any sort of vested interest in the answer? Comey also described a New York Times story as entirely wrong. Senator Tom Cotton, on February 14th, the New York Times published a story, the headline of which was, Trump campaign aides had repeated contacts with Russian intelligence. You were asked earlier if that was an inaccurate story, and you said in the main. Would it be fair to characterize that story as almost entirely wrong? Comey, yes. That's a little more specific than arguing about the general esprit de corps of an enormous organization. The Times article said Trump aides had repeated contacts with Russian intelligence. Either they did or they didn't. Comey's verdict was almost entirely wrong. Here are the Times headlines on the two falsehoods identified by the former director at the same hearing. Comey bluntly raises possibility of Trump obstruction and condemns his lies. Disputing Times article about inquiry into Russia. If Trump kills someone, it's murder. If the Times does it, it's assisted suicide. Someone should take this to the Times public editor. Oh, we can't. They fired her and abolished the position a few months into the Trump administration. Their reporting is fine. It would be different if the Times called itself the George Soros newsletter, but it doesn't do that. Trump was elected president, which means, hold on to your hat, some people voted for him. Not only that, but he got the nomination by winning more votes than any Republican in history. It might be nice to have someone writing at your newspaper who voted for him. As far as the media are concerned, rousing political debate with a testing of both sides means pitting left-wing Democrats against never-Trump Republicans. Asking never-Trumpers about the Trump administration is like interviewing Neville Chamberlain on the D-Day invasion. Katie Turr, Mr. Chamberlain, why a Second World War at all? Chamberlain, well, that's precisely the point. This is a failure of diplomacy. As I said when I returned from Munich. Don't interrupt us. We're projecting. Consider the fact that Russia, the most evil regime in the world, is accused of doing to the Democrats what the media do to Republicans every election cycle. The claim is that the Kremlin meddled in our election by, one, putting information into the public sphere during an election that the Democrats didn't want the public to know, and two, pushing deceptive memes on social media designed to help Trump and hurt Hillary. The media has been strategically releasing negative information about Republicans forever. On the upside, that's why there are never any bombshells about our presidential candidates. Any Republican who's been around long enough to run for president has had his entire life unearthed. By contrast, there are almost always exciting surprises with the Democrats' candidates. Until Michael Dukakis ran for president, it was not generally known that he had defiantly paroled a depraved murderer who then went on to torture and rape an innocent couple in Maryland. No media outlet had ever checked to see if John Kerry had been lying about being Irish his entire life and was actually Jewish. Only when he was running for president did we begin to hear of Bill Clinton's spectacular sexual assault record. Among the scandals the media have launched against Republicans in a campaign year are the repeatedly investigated charge that the first President Bush had had an affair years earlier, allegations that Senate candidate Jack Ryan had taken his ex-wife to sex clubs, and CBS's claim that the second President Bush had shirked his National Guard duty based on a source who was literally foaming at the mouth. Not Dan Rather, I mean the other guy. At least what WikiLeaks published was true. Those were real emails. The source wasn't a mentally disturbed man or an ex-wife's accusations in a custody dispute. The source was the DNC's computer hard drive. Naturally, the Democrats didn't want anyone to see their private emails. Jack and Jerry Ryan didn't want anyone to see their divorce records, which is why they filed them under seal. Donald Trump didn't want his secretly recorded remarks on an Access Hollywood tape being blasted around the globe 1 month before the election. The media did all that. Instead of reporting the news when they get it, the media acts like an opposition party, releasing negative information tactically. Ryan's sealed divorce records came out years after his divorce, but immediately after he became the GOP Senate nominee against Barack Obama. ABC News broke the story of Representative Mark Foley's sexually suggestive texts to underage male pages sent between 1995 and 2005 on September 29, 2006, the day Foley's name could no longer be removed from the ballot. NBC held on to that Access Hollywood tape until 1 month before the election. That must have taken incredible self-discipline, like keeping a chocolate bar in the freezer until you've done something to deserve it. Thanks to WikiLeaks, now the Democrats know what it's like to have negative information strategically leaked against them in an election year. As for the Russians' deceptive social media posts, how about comparing the effect of Russia's Woke Blacks Instagram account to the media's Hands Up, Don't Shoot hoax? For nearly 4 months, the entire North American press corps retailed a ghastly narrative about a white policeman in Ferguson, Missouri, gunning down an innocent black man, Michael Big Mike Brown, as he begged for his life. Eventually, we learned the truth. It turned out the media's account was a complete fabrication. Was that false story helpful to Hillary? She sure thought so. At her invitation, Brown's mother appeared on stage at the Democratic National Convention as an honored guest. How many votes did Hillary get from the cooked-up media campaign about a racist cop? How many voters were influenced by the Russians' United Muslims of America Facebook group as compared with the Access Hollywood tape of Trump that played around the clock on every network for weeks before the election? The Republican Party thought that tape had ended Trump's candidacy. According to news reports, the day after its release, RNC chairman Reince Priebus begged Trump to withdraw from the race, saying he faced certain and humiliating defeat. NBC's leaking of that tape was every bit as disreputable as WikiLeaks' publication of the Democrats' emails. Why is one illegally leaked conversation, the DNC emails, an attack on our democracy when the Russians do it, but the finest of American journalism, the Access Hollywood tape, when the media do it? What else can the media do that would be an act of war if done by foreigners? Can the Washington Post bomb Pearl Harbor? We have the Department of Justice, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and the Independent Counsel hot on the trail of a claimed Russian plot to interfere with our election by hacking the DNC's emails. Can they spare a few agents to find out who illegally leaked the Access Hollywood tape? The media's position is that they are allowed to engage in lies, deception, and even illegal acts to swing an election. But if foreigners do it, it constitutes